Hello again. I'm Kathleen Dunn. Our guest this hour is the author of Morning, Noon, and Night, Finding the Meaning of Life Stages Through Books. And Arnold Weinstein says this is the most personal book that he has written, personal in ways that he had not anticipated. For close to three decades, he's been teaching a large undergraduate class called Rites of Passage, and he deals with coming-of-age narratives from medieval France up to our own moment, using a mixture of famous writers and others who are less known but who happen to be favorites of his. One of the chief reasons, he says, for teaching this course is to urge students to realize that their own experience of growing up is surprisingly rewardingly mirrored in books from other times and other places. Exploring such texts with students is gratifying, for they easily see that their own college experience is itself a rite of passage. This book looks at two major phases of life, growing up and growing old. And we're going to talk about how literature and our own experiences of going through those phases, literature can mirror our lives and sometimes teach us more about ourselves than we know about ourselves. Arnold Weinstein researches European and American narrative, Scandinavian literature, American fiction, literature, and medicine, and the city theme in literature. His publications include, well, so many of them. He's written a number of books. A Scream Goes Through the House, What Literature Teaches Us About Life, Recovering Your Story, Proust, Joyce, Wolfe, Faulkner, Morrison, and a number of other books. He received his BA in Romance Languages from Princeton and got his master's and PhD in comparative literature from Harvard University. He has taught all over the world. He came to Brown in 1968, initially in the French department, and he has taught in Germany and in Scandinavia and in Paris. Oprah Winfrey in 2005 asked him to give four lectures on William Faulkner to be produced online in her summer book club. And we'll certainly talk about Faulkner and may start at the end of the book rather than the beginning because, self-servingly, some of us are getting old. and he's dealing with that issue as well. So we probably will start there. And then we'll go to, you know, love, although we'll talk about love in older age and we'll talk about the childhood experience. We'll be welcoming phone calls. I would think we will have many because we're going to be talking about wonderful authors, writers this hour. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Professor Arnold Weinstein, thank you so much for being with us.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Let's start with getting old, because I'm getting old now, and I'm finding it really hard, and I'm thinking this weekend, do I want to go see Death of a Salesman, which is being played at the Milwaukee Rep, or, you know, is it going to be too much for me to handle right now as I'm thinking about dying and getting old and wrapping it all up?
It may be. I'm finding, too, that getting old is not a lot of fun.
Yeah.
You know, the dark books, because somebody once said happiness has no history. So much of literature and art is about dark themes, and, of course, they can sometimes be almost too much to handle. I also think they're exhilarating. I think when people walk out of a performance of either King Lear or Death of a Salesman, part of them, of course, is down, because this is not happy stuff. It's not good news. But also, it's vibrant. It's expanding. I mean, it widens our sense of what we're about, mm-hmm. even if, you know, it doesn't necessarily reassure us.
Right. You say that there are two books you pay special attention to. One I've read, of course, but one I haven't. The Old Man and the Sea, Hemingway, and Philip Roth's Everyman. I have not read Everyman.
Yes. Well, you know, Hemingway's story is a mixed bag in the Academy. I mean, people found it a little bit sentimental, but it's, of course, a kind of epic battle between a man and a fish, and it's a love story. I mean, and it's pure Hemingway. It's about as reduced to bare essentials as it can be. And I needed to put it in the book because it's a kind of heroic depiction of a person who was nonetheless old and pretty much beat up and yet rises to these great heights in this battle, even though the fish is cannibalized by the time he gets in. So it's a picture of a kind of triumph. Roth's book, it seems to me, is a tougher book. It's more unflinching. It's about a man who got it wrong in almost every important relationship with his wives, plural, but also with his children, with his parents. And only at the end does he fully understand that. And I think that's a cautionary fable. Roth does not sermonize. But nonetheless, it's a tough-minded book about the need for perhaps seeing these things a bit earlier instead of right at the death's door realizing that you messed it up.
Mm-hmm. What about we reap what we sow? You start a chapter like this as the good book. Does literature, the wonderful works that you've been examining, support that or not? We reap what we sow.
They do, but I think it's often a kind of surprising discovery. I mean, often we don't know what we have sown until we reap it. I mean, you can think of it lots of ways. You know, when I was young, people said, go out in the sun and grease yourself up all summer long, and then 30 years later, you reap skin cancer.
Yes, yes.
But I think it's true in general. We don't know what has impacted on us until much later in life. But so I also think it's an important notion about old age. One would like to think that you come into wisdom, that you turn the experiences of your life into something that is usable in some fashion or gives you a kind of insight. And of course, sometimes that happens. But there are a bunch of books that I also deal with that give us a kind of frightening image of old age as a time for either discovering or suspecting that you haven't lived, or that you've lived wrong, or that you haven't seen things aright. So in that sense, Final Harvest can be fraudulent, that you want it to be that time, but perhaps the scary notion is that you may discover that that something has been something of a mirage.
Mm-hmm. I'm interested in your reading of King Lear at this point in your life and your students' reading of King Lear at their points in their life. You're taking completely different thoughts and reflections depending on what age you are when you read that wonderful work?
Inevitably. The students in general, I think, have some trouble truly, you know, getting into the experiences of the old and the dying. And what is remarkable about Lear is that the story of Edmund, or the story even perhaps of Goneril and Regan, in other words, the evil children, told from a different light, could be a story of growing up, of young people trying to come into their own. On the other hand, from my vantage point, of course, Lear and Gloucester are enormously pathos-filled figures. They're not only in old age, but they're betrayed by their children. And I think of it as a kind of cannibalistic play about the young devouring the old. Lear doesn't just discover, you know, his problems as a king, but as a father. And then he comes to this system-wide recognition that throughout the kingdom, he sees that the strong are devouring the weak. And perhaps it takes all of that suffering for him to see it, although it also drives him mad. I think the young can see a lot of that. I think the pathos of the older man, as Freud said about Lear, the necessity of making friends with dying, I hope that young people don't see life that way, the necessity of making friends with dying. But, of course, that's where you and I started this conversation. I mean, we are obliged, at least occasionally, to think about that.
Right. And did you think about that when you were 30 years old teaching this work of literature?
No.
No.
I mean, one knew it abstractly, but it certainly didn't have the kind of punch and terror in it that I think it has today for me.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about this whole process. I loved an interview or something that I read when a friend of yours was asked about Shakespeare and her response that Shakespeare was in many ways teaching her more about herself. He knew more about her than she knew about herself. Is that true, do you think, as we look at growing up, as we look at being born, as we look at dying? Is that true of all works of literature, that they're getting insight about yourself that you never thought about yourself?
I think it is. I mean, I often use the notion of art as a mirror. And, of course, you know, I don't want to be simplistic. It's not really. You look in a mirror and you see yourself. But I think that art, and this is a hard lesson, I think, to teach students today, is that, yes, Shakespeare tells them something about themselves, that books or plays or art that goes back centuries is, I think, illuminating. It's not clear that we have such a expansive sense of who we are. I think that we do make discoveries in books. We often see things about ourselves that we don't want to see, that they're dark features of our personality or things that are, for good reasons, put to the side. But we also see possibilities that life has not actualized in us, but that these stories, these plots, make visible to us. Someone once said that art, in a sense, gives us, it allows us to imagine a future that we can't afford to experience. If you read a text about dying, I mean, presumably if you're reading, you're not dying, but it gives you that vicarious experience. So that I do think that we bring into ourselves even the most exotic kinds of things that we read. I think that's why people read, by the way. I mean, I think they read for nurturance, for nutrients, the same way they eat, that they take into them stuff that they sense this is going to be useful. This goes against the view, by the way, that reading is, you know, doomed and that reading is a dead proposition today and that all people get their information, you know, in other formats. I don't think that's true. I think if you look on at a plane trip or a train or a bus or places where you can't look, people getting ready to go to bed, even if it's a Kindle, I think they're reading.
Right. That's a horrible thought, to think that you can't read if you're dead. You know, I wonder if you could.
Maybe that's a view of the afterlife, that a time for interminable reading, where you can catch up on all the things that you never had a chance to do.
All those books that are sitting around.
That's what they're waiting.
And half finished. I hope that's the case, along, of course, with all the dogs I've ever loved.
Well, there's much more on that list, too, of course.
Exactly. Tell me about this book. You mentioned a lot of books. I've read a lot of them. But this book that is profoundly influential in your life, and you really consider it to be just actually a must-read book. I felt like I had to read it after I read a good chunk of your book. And I don't know very much about it, The Ice Palace.
Yes. Well, my wife is Swedish, and so I, for many, many decades, have known something about Scandinavia. And this is a Norwegian novel written in the 60s, which I came on to by chance. And it's an exquisite story, in part because this man was in his 60s, a man in his 60s, writing the story of two 11-year-old girls. That in itself is proof, if you ever needed it, that art is elastic, that you can write yourself into positions that you don't occupy. But when I teach the story, you know, it's funny. I tell the students, you are already so much older than this. In fact, I taught the book yesterday.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
Oh.
So this is a good moment to talk about it. But that your 11-year-old self, I tell these 19- and 20-year-olds, is so far in the past, and I asked a rather daunting question. Have you grown larger or smaller since you were 11? Because 11 is a time of great wonder and also great risk, I think, and great sort of infatuations, which, of course, is what that book is about. And I think by the time you get to college, your system knows better. You've been burned. You know that love is risk and vulnerability. 11-year-old girls don't know that. And it's, of course, you know, as you know, it's a kind of a frightening, macabre story about two girls, and one of them dies, and the other goes through grieving and mourning and has to come through it. So I think it's an interesting story about looking back, even for young people, about a phase in their life that's far behind them and that it pays to be a bit reflective about.
Mm-hmm. What about falling in love? What great literature deals with falling in love? Is Romeo and Juliet number one?
It's got to be number one. I mean, I think it's made its stamp on the way Western culture thinks about these matters. And I love the sort of urgency of it, the breathlessness of it. But, of course, breathlessness also suggests, if we think about old age, getting out of breath, not having breath, not breathing anymore. And when I found myself writing about it, I was struck by how death is such a kind of shadow figure of the play. There's so many cadavers in that play. There's so many sort of haphazard deaths. And, of course, as often in Shakespeare, the stage is littered with corpses at the end. But it made me think about wild romantic desire as something that may be akin to death in its own way, or that it can't be sustained. I mean, people have always said that desire itself is unsustainable, that maybe youthful passion is youthful. It has its moment. But how compatible is it, for example, with lifelong relationships or with the curve of human affections over time, and that mature love includes passion, but certainly has more in it than that. So I thought that writing about growing up and growing old, it was important to imagine how love seems to come at us at those various phases of life, and how its value is very different, and how the culture, you know, has some real prescriptions about it.
Mm-hmm. And what's that? I can't remember if it's in reference to love or what. Shakespeare's, you mentioned Shakespeare's sonnet, is it number 73?
Yes. Yes. Again, I think counterintuitive about the sort of perspective of a man in his last winter, comparing himself to the bare trees and that wintry landscape, knowing that there will be no spring rebirth, and yet with this sublime conclusion that the spectacle of old age and entropy and deterioration creates in the lover more love, that you look upon the one you love who is in this decline, who is death-ridden, and it increases your sense of love. I mean, I want to believe that this is true. I don't think it's simply true. I think there is truth in it. I think we also know that the spectacle of people very sick and dying creates ambiguous or ambivalent feelings in many of us, that is not easy to deal with, and we want to rise to that. But Shakespeare's sonnet is quite lovely in that regard, that it says that this increases your love or increases my love for you.
Yeah. Do you have it in front of you or not?
No, I don't.
Okay. I want to hear it before the end of the hour. We'll figure out some way.
I'll have it before the end of the hour.
Thank you. I'd love to have you read it to us. That would be great. We're going to welcome phone calls for you. Our guest this hour is the author of a wonderful book, Morning, Noon, and Night, Finding the Meaning of Life Stages Through Books. I'm sure that you're a sophisticated audience. You've read many of the books that he mentions in this book that he has said maybe his last book. I wonder if that's the case. And he'll inspire you to read books that you haven't read just because of what he has to say about them. The book looks at growing up. He talks about William Blake and Huckleberry Finn, William Faulkner's Benji, the lessons of experience. And it has a lot to say about Charles Dickens, who really, I read a lot of Charles Dickens when I was in high school, and he was so influential in me and my life at that time. Falling in Love, Shakespeare, of course, Romeo and Juliet, and Charlotte Bronte and Emily Bronte's Wuthering Heights and Jane Eyre, Love Gone Wrong, Familial Sacrifice, The Wild Child, Growing All the Way Up, and then Growing Old. And we're welcoming your calls on this. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to your phone calls now for Professor Arnold Weinstein. The book is Morning, Noon, and Night, Finding the Meaning of Life Stages Through Books. Boyd from Milwaukee is our first caller. Hi, Boyd.
Good morning, Kathleen. Hello to your guest. Great show. It's funny you brought this up. I just happened to be reading last night Manuscript in a Bottle and was thinking about life while reading it. My question for your guest is, my undergrad was in philosophy, and I still read a lot of that, but I do read a lot of literature in order to make comparisons and try to think about life overall while reading them. What would you say might be a better format for answering life's questions, philosophy or literature? I know it's sort of a broad question, but do you think they both serve their purpose, or is one better than another? And I'll take my comment off the air.
Thanks, Boyd.
That's a great question. I think it's been asked for a long, long time. I think that many, many writers about it, both in philosophy and literature, are drawn to it. Here's how I think I'd answer it, by saying one reads philosophy. Your question said, how do we answer this? If you want answers, I think you can go to philosophy in some sense. But I think that literature is more experiential than philosophy is. We try on literary texts. In other words, when you read a book, it's like trying on a piece, article of clothing, that you endorse it in some sense. You become that figure. I don't think we're encouraged to read Aristotle or Plato or other philosophers in quite that way. So I think that there's something more cerebral and more, analytical about reading philosophy, and there's something more affective or even empathetic about reading literature. We, include both of those things as we learn about life and about ourselves. But I think art in particular pushes the experiential. And so that's how I'd answer that, that they are complementary. Each has its place, and each, in a sense, gives something that the other doesn't.
Hmm. Let's go to Joan in Milwaukee. Hi, Joan.
Hi.
Hi.
There's one book that I can't remember the name of, but somebody else will probably call it in. I'm 78, and I'm living with a 19-year-old relative.
Oh.
So the ones that have hit me lately, I got to turn the radio down.
Thank you.
The ones who have hit me lately are ones that are about relationships between younger and older people and how we learn from the young. One of them, a friend of mine gave me and said, you have to take this. You have to keep it, and I'll probably read it again. It's called The Elegance of the Hedgehog, and it switches. Each chapter is either the old person or the young person's story. And I'll reach over here and get the author.
Okay.
If you forgive me. The author is Muriel Barbery, B-A-R-B-E-R-Y, and it's quite wonderful. And two that I've read recently are The Lovely Bones and Winter's Bone, and they're both kind of macabre, but Winter's Bone was made into a movie, and I remembered the name because it's made by, or the actors were people from the backwoods of Arkansas. And it is quite a wonderful piece of literature, I think.
Hmm. And have you found literature?
Pardon me?
Have you found literature that is inspirational to you in how it handles the subject of ultimate death?
Yes, that's the one that I can't remember the name
of. Oh, okay.
Thank you. I hope somebody else calls it in.
Yeah, if it's not,
about, it's about a woman transitioning from how she grows and becomes a better person from middle age to facing dying in the death of her husband and in not giving up on her own life and becoming more flexible. I hope somebody calls it in.
Yeah, or maybe Arnold knows.
Well, The Elegance of the Hedgehog is a book that I know, and I think it's a lovely story, and it's not unusual to find books. Faulkner was very drawn to this, the relations between the old and the young. And we know it's true in life. I mean, you say that you're living with a 19-year-old. That's what one hopes for. I mean, one of the central sort of conflicts in many of the books that I deal with is the kind of warfare, really, between the old and the young. And at some cultural level, that's what happens, that the old eventually have to vacate the scene and the young move to center stage. But, of course, the alternative to that, or the other story, is the one that I think that the listener is telling us about, which there can be wonderful harmony and instruction. And I love the way it was put, that the 19-year-old teaches the 78-year-old something. Of course, it must be a two-way street. I would like to think that the 78-year-old person also teaches the 19-year-old person something. But that's the humane traffic that one wants, the two-way street. And I think that when we read great books or even lesser books, we find both of those depictions. Sometimes it can be savage, and sometimes it can be something that's very rich and developing.
Let's talk about, because you spend quite a bit of time at the beginning of the book talking about Sophocles' Oedipus the King, which you say scarcely seems to most of us to be a work about childhood, and yet it's sort of taken in the whole kit and caboodle. It's the childhood, it's the growing old, it's very, very important in how it informs psychology and all kinds of other areas of life. Where do you place it? At the beginning of life, at the end of life, both?
Well, that's, of course, the grandeur of Sophocles, that he particularly if you put with Oedipus the King, Oedipus at Colonus, and you see both sort of sides or both pieces of the diptych growing up and growing old. It's true that Sophocles is not drawn to the childhood of Oedipus, but when we read the play, we realize it's a completely benighted childhood. It's benighted at least in some key respects. He does not know who his parents are. He does not know who the man that he slays at the crossroads is. He does not know who the woman that he shares his bed with is. So in absolutely central relationships, he's in the dark. I mean, it's a very daunting picture of not knowing what, in fact, your own situation and your own conditions and relations are. And at the end, of course, he is ravaged. He's blind. He's in tatters. But at the very end of the second play, or the late play, Oedipus at Colonus, he rises to some kind of dignity and stature, and we all come to realize that his death is going to have a redemptive value for Athens. And I think that Sophocles has caught something quite rich there, because that last is a wonderful image of old age, that certainly physically we diminish, but perhaps we also can rise, that maybe there is this sort of regal last step as well. So I feel like that book looks sort of over my book at beginning and at the end. But also, as I said a moment ago, I think that that fundamental conflict between the generations, which is, of course, how Freud read Sophocles, that conflict is alive and well with us today. I mean, my own view would be you can't understand the Arab Spring, what's happening in other parts of the world where the young are taking on their elders, or what happened in America in the 1960s and in Europe where there was a kind of revolt of the entire youth generation. To me, Sophocles is already giving us a kind of skeletal version of some of that.
Hmm. Oh, that's interesting. Let's go to Rick in Milwaukee. Hi, Rick.
Yes, good morning. I wondered if Professor Weinstein could discuss Philip Roth's books a bit more in general and then specifically recommend some others other than Everyman. Everyman I began about a year ago, and I had to put it down because the text, it was delightful to read, but my eyesight is deteriorating, so I decided to go to audiobook form and something that I thought would be more humorous. So I went to Portnoy's Complaint, which I liked very much, but then I went on to a book called The Breast, a short novel that Roth did in 1972. It's only about 90 pages long in text form, and I think it's the most profound book I've ever heard or read word for word.
It's interesting, your comment about Everyman being one that was not one that you wanted to work through. I would suggest Patrimony, which is a fascinating book that Roth wrote about the death of dying, really, of his own father, and it's filled with the kind of poignancy that perhaps one does not find in Everyman. But Roth is fascinating in his own light as a man who in his 70s turns out book after book after book of sort of, you know, staggering intensity. Some of the books that one would recommend here would be The Human Stain or American Pastoral. Those are books that have gotten a lot of attention that were written late in Roth's life and career. One doesn't know what else is coming. I recently read Indignation, which is still later Roth, and I must say I didn't like it as much as some of the others. But he's going to be a towering figure in American literary history. And then there's a wild, really sort of erotically off-the-charts book called Sabbath Theater that he also wrote fairly late, which is really which strikes a lot of people as really unmanageable and over the top. But Roth is a man of extraordinary energies and range. So those are at least some of the titles that I'd recommend.
Who else will be towering figures in American literary history?
What a question. One of the things, you know, the students asked me about the canon. The canon is something that evolves. It moves. Fitzgerald, when he died, thought that no one would ever be reading his books, and that people like Emily Dickinson were unknown entirely just about when they were writing. So, for that matter, even Shakespeare's stature is something that even those who revered his work at his own during his life could never have guessed the kind of preeminence he would have. All of this should make us quite humble about who's going to be important in 20 or 30 years. I think that many of the figures continue. Shakespeare, it's been claimed, writes for every generation. Every generation rewrites him, rereads him. He says something different, in generation after generation. I think Faulkner will stay, although he's had his hard times, because there was, when I was in college, Faulkner was a kind of revered author. And then I think in the heyday of feminism and when people became more interested in issues of race, Faulkner really looked like a taboo writer who got it wrong, which has its own share of truth. He did get a lot of things wrong. But he also happened to be growing writing as an adult in a culture that itself got many things wrong. I personally grew up in Tennessee in the 40s and 50s, and I think much was gotten wrong then. So I think time does its tricks on us, that and it relativizes many of our judgments. But in fact, we can, you know, we don't read just for people's political, you know, shrewdness. We read because there's something humanly rich in there in the writings, and that's why people, writers like Faulkner, whatever his sins may be on some fronts, will endure.
What about a writer like Alice Walker? You spend some time with The Color Purple, which isn't read as much now. Where does that fit?
That's a, you know, that's a good question. I mean, it can be accused of being sentimental. I think that Seeley is one of the great characters in American literature. I think that in some odd way, Spielberg's film, where we see Whoopi Goldberg doing this lovely, you know, irresistible performance, it makes the book a little sappier and a little softer and mushier than it is. The book is tough. I think the book tells us a whole lot about how evil racism is. And the story of a young girl who was raped, who was abused by the man that she thinks is her blood father, and how she gradually, I mean, it's a coming-of-age story, but it's also like a Horatio Alger story of rags to riches. But what I really want to say is that it's earned, that this woman becomes an adult. She is a countercultural figure. She becomes a lesbian. But she also becomes empowered in her own way. And, you know, we all know that that is the American dream, is that whatever your origins are, you can become who you want. And as cynical as I sometimes am, I still believe that that dream has a lot of force and vitality in it, not just around the world, which we know it does. People come to America for that reason, but also for Americans, that it's a sense of promise. So the book, yes, it's a little bit mawkish at times, but it's a stirring story, and she has an, you know, Walker achieves a voice in that book, which we used to call Black English, which has a kind of, you know, sort of pizzazz and snap and wit that one doesn't easily forget.
I guess this hour is the author of Morning, Noon, and Night, Finding the Meaning of Life Stages Through Books. Arnold Weinstein is with us. Rick, thanks for your call. We have some lines open if you'd like to join the conversation. 800-486-8655. We also have this email thing you can use, and that is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Camille in Frankfort, Michigan. Hi, Camille.
Hi.
Hi.
In my earlier life in college, my early years in college, I got introduced to the Native American culture through a friend of mine, Navajo friend of mine, and later went into the Peace Corps, went to Africa, and my experience of the more ancient cultures, more ancient traditions, is that there is a lot more respect for elders than in more modern cultures, and I just wondered if there is anything reflected in the literature about this sort of paradoxical evolution. You know, it's kind of a de-evolution in a sense as we move forward, become more and more modern.
It's a hard question to answer because it's dead right that older cultures, traditional cultures, revered the old, that the old were thought of as repositories of wisdom, and they had a kind of stature and dignity, and that modern culture, particularly modern Western culture, I would argue, is so clearly a youth culture, and hence the type of respect that was accorded the old just doesn't exist anymore. I don't think it's just, though, that, I mean, again, Sophocles wrote that story about a person slaying his own father, and it was a kind of archetypal story as well. So I think that it's that's the ambivalence of all of this. Yes, the old have experience, and they have knowledge. On the other hand, the old are old, and they're approaching death. And at the same time, too, the old must learn at some point to either give up or refigure what power is. We see this even in terms of professions and work. The old have to retire. The old become obsolete. And yet the old also know things. Each side of this coin is true. I think the harder part, well, it's hard on both ends. I think the old need, I feel this as an old person, one wants to try to keep in balance these two notions, that one is weakening and approaching, you know, that essentially one is on the far side of the spectrum. And at the same time, one has knowledge and experience.
Yes.
And one has time. Mm-hmm. One has lived a long time, and one should perhaps see other people's lives as having time in them. I think we're very short-sighted on that. Oh, that's an old person's virtue, to understand the amount of actual temporal density, the long time that people have lived, and hence what you see with your eyes is what you see. But in fact, that covers a past, a working past, a history. Literature is interesting that way. It shows us something about that. Mm-hmm. We can't see it with our retina.
You know, it's interesting to me because I'm in the business of hearing people. I don't see people, and it's one of the reasons I love radio. I just concentrate on their words. But if I were imagining you, I know approximately how old you are because I know when you graduated from school. But I would say that the way you speak, that you sound like a person in maybe his 40s. You know, that there's a difference. There's an enthusiasm and a knowledge that you have, but it seems to me as though you still have an awful lot of life in you and you shouldn't retire.
I'm going to quote these remarks all the time, particularly to the deans of the university.
Okay, well, you should, because I think I speak the truth here. Thanks, Camille, very much for your call. Let's go next to Vince in Dodgeville. Hi, Vince.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
There's a very few books that kind of cover all three, morning, noon, and evening or night in a person's life, and Tolstoy's War and Peace, I think, is one of the very best, despite its pedantry at times and its long digressions on historical theory. And I've kind of gone back and read it every 10 years or so. In my teens, I read it for the war scenes, you know, the Battle of Borodino. I can still see where my peanut butter sandwich fell down, and I was so excited into the book, and and there's plenty of that. But then in my 20s, I read it for the love stories of youth, you know, particularly Natasha's love affairs, most of them ill-fated, with Anatole Karagin and, you know, Andre, Prince Andre. And then, you know, later in life, for the kind of the wisdom of aging and wisdom of looking back and trying to make coherent sense out of one's long life, because the book covers several decades. And at the very end, the heroine, Natasha, is now a mother, and she's married Pierre. They settle down to kind of a boring family life, in a way. But you see that love has matured, and it's gone through its tempestuous phases and its disillusionment phases, and now there's something maybe deeper, less passionate in the, you know, youthful sense, but Tolstoy called family love.
Hmm.
I wonder if our author has commented on that particular book, or if there are other books like that that take us through the phases of a person's life.
Oh, what a great call.
That was, if I were to teach War and Peace, I think I'd invite the caller
in
to give the lecture on it. That was really,
that was wonderful.
I think you're right. I mean, first of all, it's not accidental that Tolstoy has been compared to Shakespeare, because he seems to have what theorists say is impossible, which is a panoptic vision. He can see around things. He sees everything in the round, and as you put it so finely, every phase of life is understood in all of its pathos and intensity, and yet, when one returns to it a decade or two or three or four or five later, other parts of the book become more luminous to us and more meaningful to us. He understands each of these phases. I can't quite share the enthusiasm about the very end of the book. I think that it becomes just a little bit sort of hard to swallow, the final depiction of Natasha and Pierre, although I think that when they come together after the failed relationship, the failed passion, the dead passion, or what happens to Andre, all of that it has a kind of fiery intensity and horror in it. And I think that when she comes to Pierre, there's a kind of maturity and wisdom, yes, but there's also a sense in which passion has had its day. Passion has burned out. So I feel like, yes, Tolstoy is a marvelous writer for giving us all of these phases, and it would be very hard to come up with a rival who could quite manage this. I would suggest that you take a look at The Death of Ivan Ilyich, which is Tolstoy's masterpiece about the last chapter. Mm. It's a much gloomier book than War and Peace. It doesn't begin to have the scope or richness, but I think it's even a more searing account of what it means to grow old and to move and, you know, to be beset with illness and pain, and then to start asking those questions such as the final harvest. Have I really lived? Has my life been a sort of a fraud?
Arnold Weinstein is our guest this hour. His book is Morning, Noon, and Night, Finding the Meaning of Life Stages Through Books. He is a distinguished professor of comparative literature at Brown University and has written a number of other books, including A Scream Goes Through the House, What Literature Teaches Us About Life, and Recovering Your Story, Proust, Joyce, Wolf, Faulkner, Morrison. He's lecturing frequently on world literature, and those are on DVD and CDs format by the teaching company, and he's our guest this hour. So here's our number, 800-486-8655. Vince, thanks for the call. Call anytime. And our email, talk@WPR.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. To our earlier caller who was reading the recommended The Elegance of the Hedgehog, we have an email from Marcia in Madison. I think the name of the book that your caller was referring to is Every Last Cuckoo by Kate Malloy. It was read on Chapter a Day about a year ago. It's about a woman's personal journey after the death of her husband, a wonderful book, which I think I will pick up at the library this weekend and reread. And there were many books that you suggested that I haven't read in your book. But the one, you know, you brought me back to high school in one of them because I remember being so taken by Great Expectations, Charles Dickens, back when I was in high school. And I wonder why I was. Tell me why I was, Arnold.
Okay, I'm going to now psychoanalyze you and tell you exactly why you were.
Thank you.
It's a story that is, first, Pip's voice is irresistible. Secondly, it's a story, a kind of social parable that we can understand. This man moves from being an apprentice blacksmith to inheriting much money to trying to cut a figure in the world. And from the beginning, we know that this is in trouble. Something keeps telling us that this is more difficult than it seems. Of course, Pip does not know who his benefactor is. He thinks it's Miss Havisham, and he turns out to be tragically wrong. Dickens, there's always a dark underside to Dickens, mm-hmm. and I honestly think that may be why you liked it when you read it so early, Kathleen. I think one feels that Pip's experience is one that is bittersweet, that there is a kind of damage in Pip. I mean, this book opens with him, you know, at a cemetery, looking at a gravestone and trying to sort of find his place in things. And then it opens as well in the marshes, which is where the cemetery is. And the marshes suggest the kind of homelessness, it seems to me, in this book. And that Pip, it's a dark story. I mean, the infatuation that he has for Estella is one that we have serious questions about, as does Pip himself, that he loses everything. He loses Biddy. He loses Joe. That he loses his childhood. He loses his innocence. Maybe one responds to this because it whispers to us this is what we're going through. It's not a happy book.
Mm-hmm. I want to read it again. Should I read it again?
I think you should. I think you'll see the darker side in it. I don't want to suggest that Dickens is like Faulkner. I don't think it's doom and foreboding, but I do believe that there is a much that is repressed in Dickens. People have written about that even the fate of Mrs. Joe who is going to be struck by Orlik. We don't know that it's Orlik when it happens, and then will die. People have suggested that this is sort of the repressed rage of Pip, that there's something that is sublimated in this book. And again, I don't want to turn him into a neurotic, but I think Dickens is a writer who will continue to interest us, you know, in future times as well, because he has such a fine sense of what's in our daylight and what's in our twilight and what we can't really process at all, but it's there. And he puts it all onto the page in one way or another.
Okay. Let's go to Kristen in Stevens Point. Hi, Kristen.
Hi. I am so excited to hear your voice on the radio, Professor Weinstein. I was a student of yours from 1987 to 1991 at Brown. I was
a creative
literature major.
Ah.
And I just couldn't believe it. I was driving on the way to school. I also teach at the University of Wisconsin, Stevens Point.
Ah.
I teach sculpture. And I had to say that it was just so great to hear you talk about this book, and I definitely am getting it, and I'm going to read it. And I was lucky enough to take the Proust Joyce Faulkner class of yours, which was a total epiphany for me, especially Sound and the Fury. So keep teaching the Faulkner. I don't think he's out of date.
Kristen, you're giving me my Madeleine experience here. My own past is coming back. Although I was not quite the age you were when we had that course. But yes, that's delightful to hear from you.
That's great.
Wonderful. And I just wanted to say, too, that it really inspired me to pursue art myself, even though I didn't pursue literature. But the way that you taught and combining art and literature and talking about how the writers wrestle with these ideas has definitely inspired me as an artist and also a teacher. So I thank you.
Well, I thank you, too. It's very gratifying to hear what you just said.
There you go. A life well lived. You got it.
One would like to think so.
Yeah.
That's our great hope.
Thanks, Kristen. Leland is next from Viroqua. Hi, Leland.
Hi. I too am enjoying tremendously your talk about literature. I was gifted with a mother who, as she put it, read everything in the local town library by the time she was about 16, and then she started on everything else. She read continuously my whole life, and she was always great about turning me on to wonderful books, and in whatever phase I was in. And I guess I was sort of hooked on a thought a little while back. You were talking about how, or someone asked, I think, about which was a better way to approach these points of our lives, either philosophy or literature, and I can think of many books that do both. One of them, and as well, an arc of a life. One of my favorites growing up was a book that literally starts with the birth of the main character and literally ends with his death, and that's kind of a rare thing in its own. It's a big meaty novel called Anthony Adverse by Hervey Allen. I don't know if you ever read that one.
No, I don't know it.
That's from the 30s. anyway, it's a great one, and it's just, it has everything: life, love, loss, betrayal, loyalty, friendship. It has it all, and it's a wonderful one.
What's the name of it again?
Edward Abbey's last novel, The Fool's Progress, which came out just about 15 years ago. And similar kind of a thing, but totally philosophical, and yet it's basically the story of his life.
Hmm.
Well, philosophy is a very encompassing field, and I'm comfortable with the view that literature also contributes to that. I did want to stress the experiential side of books. And I'd like to stress something else that I hear in your call about your mother. I heard a wonderful lecture once where a man talked about the iconic image of a professor that he had in his own mind reading to a class with a book in his hand. You've given us a more domestic and intimate picture of a mother who had read everything by the time she was 16. But the sight of someone whom you respect or love reading with a book in his or her hand, that inspires. It doesn't just inspire, it convinces. My students, I know, are more persuaded by my enthusiasm than they are by my intellect. I think that's what's contagious. I think what you convey, and this needs to be conveyed in our culture today, where books, I think, are underappreciated, what it conveys is that books are real. They're physical, because you even have to hold a Kindle or a regular old-fashioned book, and that you turn those pages, and that there is something intimate and powerful happening, that if you took a picture of somebody reading, you wouldn't see very much. You'd just see the eyelids twitching, but something is happening. There is traffic going on between the printed word and the human mind, and it's two-way traffic. The book goes into you, you go into the book, and we start learning that through our teachers and our parents.
Yes, we do. And on that note, we have to say goodbye. We never got to Shakespeare, but go to Sonnet 73, everybody, to end the show just off the air. Well, you are so enthusiastic and smart. Thank you very, very much for writing the book and being with us.
My great pleasure.
Our guest this hour, Arnold Weinstein. The book is Morning, Noon, and Night, Finding the Meaning of Life Stages Through Books. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour, Chrissy Pease for on-air production. That was fun, wasn't it? Until tomorrow.